All right, we're beginning here on the top of Yud Gimel Amud Aleph with the new Perek. The mission begins, Kol Yad Amar Bet Livdok B'Nashim. The more a woman does a check, Mishubechet, we would consider that praiseworthy. That's something that is worthwhile engaging in. U'B'Nashim Tikatzetz. Whereas by a man, we would say, cut it off. And we'll see again in the Gemara what is meant by both of these statements. The important factor is that we just finished the previous parak saying that by women, we have certain rules with regards to their checking. That is if they are a sukkah b'tarot. If they're involved with tarot, then we say that we have prescribed checking time, shachrit arvit, plus lifnei tashmish, achar tashmish. And then here you have a mishnah saying, kol yadam arbet livdok v'nashim mishubechet. So what's the interplay between those? And then we also saw that if it wasn't in the context of Taharot, then we would recommend that the women don't do checks because of Libo Nokfo. That causes the man to feel that there's something amiss, and therefore he won't want to engage in Piriya Virivya. So over there, we wouldn't seemingly encourage the woman to do more checks. So how does this Mishnah reconcile with what we saw in the previous Perek? So if it's a case when Eina Sukkah B'Taharot, then you would have to say that this would only be true if it wasn't in front of her husband or if it wasn't with the knowledge of her husband, because then it doesn't create the problem of libo nokfo, especially according to the Rishonim, as we saw yesterday, that say that a woman does check today, even absent the issue of tarot. That's depending on how you read the last line of the Gemara yesterday. The other possibility, which is maybe more likely, is in the case of a sukkah b'tarot, where we said checking is beneficial. Over there, we say that the more you do, the better, because the more times you check, the better off you are, because then you know exactly when the woman became Tmeah, and you don't lose Tarot, you don't have problems with Tarot. There are those that point out that there is a limit to that, because there's a point of diminishing returns, which is that a woman who checks herself too often, then will run herself into a problem. She'll cause herself issues, because she'll find herself Tmeah many more times, or cause herself issues with that. And therefore, when we say here that you should do more, it would be certain about more. A little bit more doesn't mean excessive checking because of the diminishing returns and the extra, maybe even negative associations with checking too often. So here we have a Mishnah that states that as far as a woman is concerned, that is praiseworthy to do more checks. By a man, we say, cut it off. Mishnah Nashim or Mishnah Anashim. Why is there any difference between women and men over here? Nashim lav v'not hargasha ninhu. Women do not have sensation, so therefore mishubachot. We consider it praiseworthy. Anashim dibnei hargasha ninhu. Men, on the other hand, that do have a sensation, tikatzeitz. Then we say cut off their hand. The Rishonim over here have generally three approaches to what the distinction is here between women and men. Rashi says over here, hargasha, man can self-stimulate, and by self-stimulating, he will have a hotzat zera or shechvat zera, and that's what causes the problem by men versus women. Women don't have that issue. Men do have that issue. So that's Rashi's view of it. You can see that in the Tosfot Arosh. He says, Perish Rashi, Sheinu mitchamamot v'ro'ot keri machmat mishmush, that they don't get stimulated and have sightings of keri because of that touching. The Tosfot Arosh makes a diuk, similar diuk is made in the Balei Tosfot over here, mashma. From here you would conclude, ha'im mit chamamot, had they become stimulated by it, asur, that would be problematic. Alma nashim muzarot al chashachatat zera. That means that women are commanded not to spill their seeds, and that comes to an understanding of the Rishonim that they believe that both the man and the woman produced zera, not the way that we know today that conception happens, that the man's zera fertilizes the egg of the woman, but they felt that the woman's produced some sort of zera, quote-unquote, as well. And so therefore Rashi says that the difference is that a man, through stimulation, will spill his seed, whereas a woman, when she stimulates, won't have any impact. But as the Tosfot Rosh points out, according to that view in Rashi, if she was able to stimulate herself, and then that would cause a spilling of seed, that would be problematic. Again, that assumes that a woman has seed to spill, and also has the assumption that there is a problem with spilling that seed. That's the view of Rashi. There is a different view in the Rabbeinu Chananel. The Tosafot HaRosh brings it as an addendum to Rashi, but it definitely is a different view here. The Rabbeinu Chananel says that Nashim v'lo b'not hargashaninu. Women can have sightings of dam without any sensation, which means that she could become tamei'ah despite the fact that she didn't have a sensation of the release of the dam. And whether that means that's a practical thing, which is women just sometimes have sightings of dam without feeling, or is that Rabbeinu Chananel is saying that even without hargasha, a woman's sighting makes her tamei'ah, and therefore she needs to check to see if such a thing has taken place. So the Rabbeinu Chananel says that la b'nei hargashaninu means that their tum'ah can be generated without any sensation, and therefore the only way to identify it or to know that it happened is to keep checking. Whereas by a man, when it comes to shechvat zera, a man has a sensation that the shechvat zera has been released, and therefore he's always aware of the fact that the shechvat zera has been released. That's what it means, b'nei hargashah, which is that the awareness of the tum'ah, irrespective of the checking. By a man, you can be aware of it without having to check because of the physical sensation. Whereas by a woman, she can have a discharge without ever having any sensation. And that's why you need to check by the women. That's the view of the Rabbeinu Chananel. Based on his opinion, it's easy to explain the upcoming Gemara, which is the upcoming Gemara says that when it comes to Zov of a man, there we do encourage you to check. And that is because, as the Rabbeinu Chananel explains, there is no Hargasha over there. The release of the Zov or the Zav emission is not something that comes with the Hargasha. Given that, we allow or encourage you to do the checks, because those checks will find the Tumah when there isn't a sensation. So according to Rabbeinu Chananel, it's very easily explainable. According to Rashi, it's much harder to explain why we would allow you to check by Zov if we have the problem that it could self-stimulate and cause Ashkata Zera. And we see that checking with Ashkata Zera is not allowed. So you have to explain why, according to Rashi, you're allowed to check by Zov. That's not as easy as it is for the Rabbeinu Chananel. The Balei HaTosafot bring another explanation for the distinction over here, which is that the women are Mazria Bifnim, and the man is Mazria Bachutz. So there, Tosafot explains that it's only called Hashchata Zera when the Zera leaves the body of the individual. That means for a man, where the Zera leaves the body of the man, that's called Hashchata Zera. On the other hand, for the woman, where the Zera stays internally, again with this belief that a woman is Mazria, then since it stays within her body, that's not called Hashchata Zera Levatala. So according to that view of the Balei Tosafot, it doesn't really matter. Even if the women were able to stimulate themselves in such a manner to release the Zera, it has no impact because of the fact that it stays internally with the woman. The man has a problem because it's discharged externally, and that's what causes the distinction. And then the Balei Tosafot and the Tosafot HaRosh bring the Rabbeinu Tam, who has the most radical view over here, which is that he says that the reasoning over here is because of Piriya Virivya. Man is mitzuveh on Piriya Virivya. A woman is not mitzuvah on Piriya Virivya. So a man who has a din or a requirement of Piriya Virivya, Hashchatat Zera, is a problem for such an individual. A woman who doesn't have such a command doesn't have a restriction against Hashchatat Zera. So both the Balei Tosafot and the Rosh point out, then according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, who says that there is a din of Piriya Virivya both for the man and the woman, then the woman would also have this problem because she is commanded in Piriya Virivya. That's number one that you would have to say about the Rabbeinu Tam. Number two is, if a man already accomplished the mitzvah of Piriya Virivya, would that mean that there's no longer an issur of Hashchatat Zera? That would be the conclusion that you would come to. The Rosh tries to back away from that assumption because he says that there is an additional din derabbanan after the Kiyum Piriya Virivya, which is Babokas Ratzarecha, the Erev Al Tanach Yadecha, which is brought in the Gemara and Yivamot, with regards to the necessity to continue to have children even after Piriya Virivya. So he thinks that the din of Piriya Virivya stays even after that point in time. And Tosfot, in rejecting that view of the Rabbeinu Tam, also points out that he thinks that even though a woman is not mitzuvah in pru or vu, but she is equal to a man, b'chol onshin shebetorah. And the onshin shebetorah means hashkatat zera levatala. And again, if you believe the woman has zera, and it's zera levatala, then there should be a problem with that as well. Now, even though it doesn't make so much sense that if you're not connected to the atzei of pru or vu, that you should be connected to the atzei zera levatala, we're going to see later today that there might be two aspects of atzei shekva zera levatala, and then the woman might be exempted from one of them, but still might be chayevit for the negative aspect of it, and we'll discuss that on the second half of today's daf. And again, according to the Rabbeinu Tam, it wouldn't matter that the women, even if they were stimulated, that they're motzi zera, because they're not in the world of hashkatat zera, because they don't have any din in piria viribya. They don't have any din of procreation, and therefore, absent that, they never have an issue of hashkatat zera. The Rabbeinu Tam himself has an opinion based on that with regards to the Gemara that says in Yevamot that three women engaging in intercourse with contraception, because the dangers that are involved to the woman if she doesn't have biyah with contraception. From there, it sounds like other women are not permitted to use contraception. That's the way the most Rishonim read it. These three women are permitted. Other women are not permitted. But for the Rabbeinu Tam, there's no reason why it should not be permitted over here, because, as Rabbeinu Tam says, a woman's not mifkedet al piri viribya. So then why are other women restricted? So he reads it in a different manner. He reads it that these three women must use contraception, whereas other women don't have to use contraception, but if they do use contraception, it would not be problematic because of the fact that they are not mifkedet al piri viribya. So that's how the Rabbeinu Tam reads it. So then, the other opinions, like Rashi and the Ben Ochananel, say the problem and why other women can't use contraception is because of the problem of chashkatat zera, which, according to them, is a problem for the woman. It's just that in our cases, it's not generated, or it's not an issue because she's not mitchamemet, or because of the fact that we need her to check, because otherwise we won't know that she's tmeah. But according to the Ben Utam and the Balei HaTosafot, it's harder to understand this. Again, the Rabbeinu Tam reads the Gemara slightly differently to solve the problem, whereas the Tosafot HaRosh brings the answer that it's asur mishum shemashchitot zera'ish, because the contraception is not problematic from the woman's standpoint, it's problematic from the man's standpoint, which is that the man is then blocked from having piri arivya accomplished, and the problem with using contraception is not because it blocks the woman's zera, but because it blocks the man's zera, and that causes a problem. And that will lead us to something that we're going to see on the second half of today's daf, which is what exactly is the issur over here of hashkatat zera. Maybe there are different components to it, so we'll leave that for later on in the daf. It says, if you're right about the difference between bnei hargasha and not bnei hargasha, ihachei ma'iria marbe. Why does it matter if you do it a lot? And if the problem is stimulation, then what does it have to do with doing it a lot, whereas we say by the woman it's good, by the man it's bad? By the man, kilo marbe nami. Even if he doesn't do it a lot of times, it's problematic. So my answer is, kiktani marbe anashim tano. That the marbe is on the woman's side of the Mishnah, which is there doing more is praiseworthy. So that's how we solve the problem. By a man, even one time is problematic because of the problem of stimulation or what we saw in all the Rishonim over here. Now, the Gemara qualifies the Mishnah and says, that's only true when it's talking about a semen or omission. Of all the inyan zov, when it comes to the emissions of the zav, afu mishubach kinashim, then by the man, it's also praiseworthy. So that is something where I said before, according to Rabbeinu Chananel, it's easy to understand, because Rabbeinu Chananel says the whole question here is, do you have a sensation of the release? And by zov, you don't have it. And there we would permit you. It has nothing to do with the shechvat zera being spilled or self-stimulation. According to the other Rishonim, where it's driven by stimulation, then why is there a heter over here to check by the zov? Why is there an override somehow that says that checking by zov overrides the problem of hotzat shechvat zera levatala or the safe self-stimulation? It's not exactly clear, according to those Rishonim, why it is by the zov that we permit it. Then in addition to that, Afilu Inyan Shechvat Zera, even by Shechvat Zera, Imbali Bok Bitzror or Becheres Bodek, he wants to check with a stone or a shard of pottery, there you can use it. Uber Matlit, lo. But you're telling us that you can't use a cloth to check. Batanya Bodek Atzmo Bimatlit. You're allowed to check yourself with a cloth. Ubechol Davar Shirotzen. Or anything else that you choose to do the check with. Kedamara Baye Bimatlit Ava. It's talking about a very thick cloth, which is both thick and coarse. Halkanami, our case here, is also Bimatlit Ava. It's talking about a thick or coarse cloth that he's using. Beheit Marde Abaye. Where was the original statement of Abaye made that we're now drawing on that statement to explain the bright over here? Ahaditnan. It's on this Mishnah. Ayochel b'truma b'irgish. He was eating truma, and suddenly he gets a sensation that he is having a seminal emission. Shiznazu evarav. And his whole body is shaking or tensed up. Ochez b'amato. He grabs a hold of his member. Uboleah tzat truma. And then he swallows the truma. So Gemara says, Ochez? How can he grab a hold of his member? Vatanya, don't we have a brighter? Rabbi Eliezer Omer, kol ochez b'amato umashtin. Anybody who holds their member and urinates, kilu mevi mabul le'olam. So if he's bringing the flood to the world, we'll explain in 1 second what's the connection. Amar Abaye b'maklit ava. It's a case where he's using a thick cloth in order to hold on. So you see here that maklit ava overcomes the issue of the stimulation. Rav Amar afilu tembe b'maklit raka. Rava says, even if you use a thin cloth, kevin de akar, akar, because the emission has already happened. The problem here is not that he's going to stimulate whatever stimulation, whatever caused the emission is already taking place. So what's done is done. The only thing is that you want to stop it from exiting the body. But Baye Chayish Dilma Ataleh Sufet. Baye says that you could have continued emissions because of the contact with the member. But Rava lo chayish dilma atalei sufei. Rava doesn't worry about the fact that this is going to add on additional release. Velo, is that true? Vatanya, halamad zeh domeh. What is this similar to? Meaning the expulsion of the shichvat zera or the stimulation of the aver. Lenotein etzba ba'ayin. That's like putting your finger into one's eye. Shekol zman she'etzba ba'ayin ayin midamat. As long as you keep the finger in the eye of the individual, it causes it to redden, it causes irritation, become bloodshot. The more you keep the finger in the eye, the more it irritates. You don't get rid of the irritation until you pull the finger out of the eye. And therefore, see that touching the aver has negative ramifications even after the emission has taken place. So Rava, kol achmuye v'chader achmume, he says, at the moment that the stimulation's already taken place, the ejaculation's taken place, you can't have continued stimulation there that'll cause additional emissions to take place. When there's time given in between, or there's a slow emission that's taking place, then the stimulation will continue to cause excess or additional emissions to take place. So just to take a step back and understand here, first of all, there are two types of emissions that an individual can have. There is an emission of shichvat zera, which is a seminal emission, and there is a zav emission, which comes from a choli, which comes from sickness, that is a different type of emission that even though it comes from the same place, it has a distinction between it, and Rashi and the Gemara in other places notes that the distinction between them is the consistency and the color of that which is being emitted. By a zov, it's doma lemei batzek shel se'orim. Is like the waters that are associated with the kneading of a dough made out of barley. That discolored water is the color of the zov, as well as the consistency of the zov. The baba basara meit. And it comes from an aver that is not stimulated, that is not erect. Shichvat zera, baba basar chai. That comes from an aver that is erect. Ukshura kiloven abeitza. And it has viscosity like the white of an egg. She'ena miluzeret. That's not scrambled. Like the albumen of the egg where It has a very tight consistency and viscosity, and it has that whitish, watery consistency to it. That's shechvat zera. So that's the first thing to distinguish between shechvat zera and zav. Number two is, both of those are not metameh de adam until it exits the individual. It has to leave the body of the individual in order for it to be metameh the individual. So the scenario here is a case where, first of all, is the zeh kol eferav, which means a person's already gone through the process of which will lead to the emission of the semen because he's had all the physical manifestations of that which leads to an emission. The only thing that hasn't happened is he hasn't emitted the semen yet. So what he wants to do is stop the emission long enough that he can swallow the truma, long enough that he can finish the truma that he's eating. Because as soon as it's emitted, he becomes tamei, and now he has a problem with the truma that he's chewing or he's eating right now. So in order to avoid that, we tell him to grab on, stop the emission, and then swallow. Now the problem with that is, we are saying here, quoting from the Braita, and we're going to see more and more through the daf today, that one is not allowed to touch their member, especially unnecessarily, but even for urinating, one is not allowed to touch their member. So over here, how does he have the right to grab his member in order to stop the emission of the zera? What we tell him to do is grab onto his member, but we see that there are negative statements about touching your member. Those negative statements involve Dora Mabul, and that, as Rashi notes over here, is because there is a connection between Hashkata Zera and the punishment of the Dora Mabul. Because the Pasuk says, Ki Hishchid Kol Basar, and Hishchid Kol Basar, the Gemara reads as that they were Mashchit Zera, and they know that because it says, Birotchim Kilkalu, Gemara Rosh Hashanah says, they did things wrong in the heat, therefore they were punished with hot water, Midah Keneged Midah. As Rashi says, the Mitchameim Gufo, they stimulated, they got their desires to fire up, and then they had Hishchid Kol Basar, they had Hashkatat Zera, and so that's one of the sins of the Dora Mabul, and that's why it says here, someone who touches their member when they go to urinate, it's as if they bring Mabul the Olam, because they're doing the same thing, or causing the same problem that happened at the time of the Dora Mabul. And the fear is that if one grabs the member, that it's going to cause stimulation. Then in our situation, Vayi brings us a solution to that problem and says, well, over here he's doing it with matlitava. He's doing it with a thick cloth. And a thick cloth that is also coarse is no different than a stone and a cheres, which are objects that do not cause stimulation because they are rough. They are not things that cause desire or give a sensual sensation, and therefore they're okay to use in holding the member or checking the members. If you use a stone, kli cheres, matliyava, it's okay. And that's what Abai says here. The Mishnah that says once you grab hold of themselves to stop the emission, they are doing it with the matlitava, so there's no problem of stimulation. And that's Abai's solution. And that also will be the solution over here by checking for zov, that you can check with a matlit, because it's a matlit that is so thick and coarse that it doesn't have that effect. The halacha, the Mishnah Berurah notes that many people don't use a matlit ava for these situations because we don't know the definition of what's considered to be ava and what's considered to be raka. What is soft? What is thick and coarse? What is thin and soft? We don't know where that threshold is, and therefore people don't necessarily use this heter in order to deal with it. Rava comes along and says, you don't even need that. Over here you can even use a thin cloth because whatever stimulation that is going to take place has already happened. He's already reached the point of full experience in terms of his seminal emission, and therefore touching anymore is not going to create any more stimulation. It's not going to add anything over here. Bai says, no, because it can cause more emission of shechvat zera. Rava says about that, that's not always true. It depends how the shechvat zera is being emitted. If it's being emitted through a experience of an orgasm and an ejaculation, you're done. It's over. And therefore, the additional touching is not going to cause any more emission. If it's coming out in slow form or in a slower type of emission, there additional touching will cause more and more to be emitted. That's what Rabbah says. That Breita that told us that if you continue to touch the eye, it causes more and more irritation. Similarly, over here, when you touch the member, it causes more stimulation. That's not in a situation where you've reached the peak desire, the chamumet. Once you've done that, it's over. But in situations where it's a slow stimulation, there you're right. If you keep touching, if you keep stimulating, it's going to cause a problem and cause more emission. And that's why there it's problematic. Over here, it's not problematic. Abayi says, even in this situation, we worry about adding to the problem, and therefore we don't want you touching it with a thin cloth or a soft cloth. All right, now the Gemara says, Gufa. It wants to investigate this brayta that we brought. Anyone who urinates while holding on to their member, kilu mevi mabul yolam. It's as if he brings a mabul. Amrulo the Rabbi Eliezer. Halo nitzotzot nitazin al raglav. Don't you have the problem that little drops then will splash onto his feet, onto his legs? Meaning if you do not project the urine away from the body, when the individual urinates, he's going to get splashes onto his feet, onto his legs. Benirek yikrot shifcha. And then he looks like someone who has an anatomical problem with their member, which doesn't allow them to urinate and create an arc away from their body. And then, if that is true, that means that they also don't have the capacity to emit shichmat zera with force, and that means that they could not impregnate a woman. If that's true, nimsa motzilaz albanav, then he's causing rumors or negative implications for his children, because the people assume shame mamzerim, that children were born of another father because he doesn't have the capacity to impregnate his wife because he doesn't have the physical ability to do that. That's indicated through his inability to urinate afar and causing splashing on his body. So then they say to Rabbi Eliezer, if you don't allow him to deal with this urinating issue, then he's going to have negative ramifications as far as the standing of his children and the way people look at his children because of the splashing of the urine back onto him. Amar lahen, he responds to them, mutav shiutzi lazal banav, shein mamzirin, better that these disparaging rumors get out, and that he's not doing something that's wrong or incorrect before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's better to do the right thing than to worry about rumors. Tanya Yidach. We have another brayta. Amalein Rabbi Eliezer the Chachamim. Efshar yamod adam b'makom gavoa v'yashtin. There are solutions to this problem. Let him urinate from a place that is high up. High up means that the place that he's standing is elevated versus where the urine's going to fall. So when the urine falls, it's going to fall away from him and it's not going to be able to bounce back or splash back onto him. O yashtin v'yafar tichoach. Or he should urinate into soft earth, where again, the urine will be absorbed and not bounce back, and then splashing won't happen onto him. And then he won't have to do something that's evil, incorrect, in front of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, meaning he won't have to touch his aver. Hey, Amar Lahu Bereisha. Which of these two brightot took place first? Ilema B'Kamaita Amar Lahu Bereisha. It was the first brightot where he says it's a sur, it doesn't matter. But the Amar Lahu Yisura Hadar Marluhu Takanta, after he told them it's totally asur, then he told them the solution to the problem. Doesn't make sense in the logical order. He's saying, it doesn't matter. Even if it splashes on his feet, I don't care, it's asur. And then afterwards he's telling them, oh, he could do this, he could do that. It doesn't really matter what he could do. You already told them that it doesn't matter. Even if it splashes, it doesn't matter. You still think it's asur. Elaha Amarlu Bereisha. It must be that this second bright that was said first, Bamrulay, he says, I think he should urinate in a high location or an elevated location or into soft earth, and that'll solve the problem. Chamim respond and say to him, what happens if he doesn't have that available to him? He doesn't have those options available to him. Then he responds with the first bright that we brought, which is, doesn't matter. Even if you can't find a solution to the problem, I still think it's a sore. So better that they have these disparaging rumors that he does something wrong in this instance. So you see from Rabbi Eliezer, he takes a very strong stance over here against touching one's member, even at the risk of disparaging rumors coming out about his children. because it's asur, and it's so problematic, it's so deleterious, as we're going to see, that he'd rather uphold that isur rather than worry about the disparaging rumors that could come from it. B'chol kach lama. Why is it so problematic? Why is it so deleterious to be touching one's member? Because touching one's member causes the unnecessary emission or discharge of one's semen. And that is a serious violation. Anyone who emits, discharges semen without any reason for no purpose, chayav mita. He is subject to a death penalty. Obviously, death penalty here means mita bidei shamayim, because the psukim say by the children of Yehuda that married Tamar. So the first one that married Tamar was his eldest son, Er, and he did a rab in Hashem, and Hashem kills him. And then Yehuda says to Onan, you should go and do yibum with the wife of your brother, and v'hakim zera l'achicha, so that you can produce an offspring that will be instead of your brother. V'yada Onan, ki lo loya zara. Onan knew now that the child that would be born would not be his, but rather would be attributed or connected to his brother. V'yayim ba el eshet achiv. So then, when he would then cohabitate with the wife of his brother, v'shichet arza, he would then not allow for the zera to remain within the woman, but rather he spilled it on the ground. So that he wouldn't produce a child for his brother. That which he did was considered evil and terrible in the eyes of Hashem. Hashem killed him for doing that. So you see here an association between death penalty, mita bidei shamayim, and hashkatat zera levatala. Mishichet arza is the sin that he does, and the result is a death penalty or mita bidei shamayim. Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Ami, Amar, Kilu Shofech Damim. It's as if he is spilling blood. It's as if he is killing. Shine Amar, because it says, Hanechamim Be'ilim. Those that are heated up are excited with lust. Tachat Kol Eitz Ra'anan, under all the trees. Shochatei Yeladim Benechalim, those that slaughter the children in the riverbeds, the wadis. Tachat Si'ifei Haslaim, under the clefts of the stones or the bedrock. So obviously here in Perek Nun Zion, it's speaking about negative things that people are doing, the bad that they're engaged in. And so these are individuals who are inciting within themselves lust, desire. Amongst the terebinths, under every verdant tree, they are slaughtering the children amongst the clefts of the rocks. So that's the translation of the pasuk, the simple translation of the pasuk. And then, al tikri shochate, don't say it's the ones who are slaughtering the children, ela sochate, from the schita, that squeeze out the children, or the potential children, and that's a reference to hotzat shechvat zera levatala, vasyamar kilo oveid avodat kochavim. It's as if he worships a avodah zera. Tibachat tachat kol eitz ra'anan. Over here it says, tachat kol eitz ra'anan, meaning the pasuk in Yeshayahu, which is a reference, again, to Motzi Shechvat Zera Levatala, Ktiv Hotam, and the Pasuk in Devarim says, Al Harim Haraim Etachat Kol Eitz Ra'anan. It's identifying where the Avodah Zarah is, and it mentions Tachat Kol Eitz Ra'anan, under the terebinth trees. So you see that there is a Gezeirah Shavah, a Gadik Gezeirah Shavah, that says that Shechvat Zera is also then Ki'ilu Oveid Avodah Zarah. It's connected to Avodah Zarah as well, which is interesting here. They connected to both Shvichat Damim, to killing, and to Avodah Zarah, which are both part of the three cardinal sins that one is obligated to give up their life for. There's a question raised by the Achronim as to whether there is a requirement to give up one's life rather than be Mashchit Shechvat Zerah Levatala. If you compare it to Shvichut Damim and Avodah Zarah, how literally do we take that? The same question that we have with regards to Busha, where the Gemara says that anybody who causes embarrassment another one is kilu shofech damim, if he killed him. So over there again, do we say that it's if he killed him, and we take it very literally to the point where we say that it would then be under the three cardinal sins and you have to give up your life, which is the way the Gemara reads it. In the case there, the Gemara says that the reason Tamar does not identify Yehuda is because mutav, shipol atzmo l'shkib shana esh, better that you get thrown into a fire or be burnt at the stake then embarrass someone. So the Gemara there seems to take it very literally that if it's Kilu Shofech Damim, better to give up your life. Now, whether that's an obligation or is that just a Militza, but over there it sounds like you have to give up your life. If that's true there, then maybe over here too, one would have to give up their life because it's Kilu Shofech Damim, O Avod Avod Zara. Although most Achronim say that it's a Derech Militza to teach you the severity of a Motzi Shechvat Zer LaBatala. It's not a literal expression, but rather an expression of the severity of the sin, so people understand what the gravity of the situation is. Rav Yehuda Ushmuel, Abu Kaimei Aigra, they were standing up on the roof to bake nishta of the shul, the Shaf V'yativ. Rashi over here says Shaf V'yativ is the name of a place that is within the Malchut Narda. So it's Shaf V'yativ. It sits inside of the region of Narda, or the boundaries of Narda. That's one explanation given over here. Another explanation, it was destroyed and rebuilt. Shaf, it was destroyed, and then Yativ was rebuilt. Rashi in Megillah on Daf Chavtet brings that Shaf Yativ was a specific shul in Narda that was built from stones and earth that they brought in the Galut when Yechaniah, king of Yehuda, ascended to Galut. They bring with them stones and earth of Eretz Yisrael, and from that they built the shul of Shaf Yativ bin Narda, and that is to be Mikayim the Pasuk, Veratzu Abadeha et Abaneha. The individuals will long for the stones and the earth of Eretz Yisrael, and they brought it there as a siman that they were going to go back, or that they longed for a return to Eretz Yisrael. And that's the Shaf Yativ bin Narda. But anyway, they're on the roof of the shul. Amalei Rav Yehuda l'Shmuel Tzurechani Lashtin. Yehuda says to Shmuel, I need to go to the bathroom. I need to urinate. Amalei Shinina, it's the nickname that Shmuel gives to his Talmid Muvak Rav Yehuda. Again, it has different connotations. Shinina can mean the sharp one, which is way most translated throughout Shas. It means that the sharp one, because he was his Talmid Muvak. Others say that it was an identifying mark. Shinina means the one with long teeth. And it was a way to identify which Rav Yehuda we were speaking about. Achuz v'amatcha, grab your member, v'ashtein l'chutz, and then urinate outwards. Someone says, hey, chiyal b'rochi, how did he do that? V'atanya, Rabbi Eliezer Meir, kolochez v'amato, mashtein, anyone who holds on to his member and urinates, kilu mevi mabul le'olam. It's as if he brings the mabul to the world. Amar Abaye asok boleshet. They made him like invading marauders. It's not. We have a Mishnah with regards to this in Avodah Zarah. This has to do with Nisuch HaYayin. Boleshet shenichnas deir. You have invading marauders that come into the city. B'shat shalom. In time of peace, where they don't feel under pressure, chaviot tuchot asurot, any open barrels are assumed to now be yayin nesech, because they would have time to be menasech them. Stumot mutarot. If they're still sealed, then they're mutarot, because they couldn't have done anything with them. They weren't open. B'shat melchama. If the battle is still raging, and they're under pressure to move quickly, elu ve'elu mutarot. Then, whether it's open or closed, all the wine is mutar. They don't have any time to do nisu chayayin because they're under pressure because of the battle. Alma, kevin de be'ite lo ate de insuche. Because they're fearful, they're under pressure, the battle is raging, they don't have time, they don't think about doing nisu chayayin. Hachanami, so to over here, kevin de be'ite, since he is fearful, this is being a Rav Yehuda, lo ate de hurhure. He's not going to come to having improper thoughts. He's not going to come to a state of stimulation because of the overriding fear that is gripping him at this point. Bacha might be ituta ika. What is the fear that is gripping Rabbi Yehuda in this case? We understand by the boleshet, you're dealing with war. We understand why they're fearful. Why is Rabbi Yehuda fearful over here? Ibai deima bituta delelya uda igra. It was night and it was on the roof. So he was afraid of where he was standing and where he would be able to urinate without getting it on himself, on someone else. So there's factors that are nighttime, being high up on a roof, that make you fearful, and that's what the fear was. It was the fear of his Rebbe. He's standing in front of his Rebbe, and that's enough fear that shakes him enough that he's not going to have all of a sudden improper thoughts there. It was the fear of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, which here you can look at it in one of two ways. And it was a shul. And he didn't want to urinate on the roof of the shul, are on the walls of the shul, and therefore he wanted to make sure that the urine went beyond that point. So that's biututa de shechina. Or it can simply be the fact that they're in the presence of a shul or the presence of a Kodesh Baruch Hu that gave him a certain amount of fear. That Rabbi Yehuda was unusual that he walked around in a state of fear of Shaviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid. He always felt Hashem was present, and therefore he wouldn't even have the possibility of Hirhurim, because Kari Shmuel Alei, Shmuel said about his own Talmid, Rabbi Yehuda, Ein Zel Yulodisha. This individual is not a human being. He's a malach. He's like an angel. And therefore, he wasn't worried about it. It was for Rabbi Yehuda. It was a special dispensation. All the other dispensations would apply to anyone. This dispensation would only apply to Rabbi Yehuda because he has this unique standing. That he was married. And if he's married, then he has an outlet for the stimulation. And therefore, we don't worry about it. Damar of Nachman, because we have a memory from Yachman, Imaya Nasui Mutar. That if he is married, then he is Mutar. Tosafot over here brings the Gemara from Shabbat that says Rabbi was called Ravino HaKadosh because he never touched his member. His hand never went below his belly button. And Tosafot says, what's the problem? He was married. So Tosafot says, despite the fact that you're married, there still is a Lifnim Yeshur at the dinner. It's still better not to touch one's member, even if they are married. The Poskim over here also deal with the fact as whether his wife needs to be Muteret to him. If she's in Ida, or if he's away from his wife, does this heter still apply? The Mishnah Berurah in general leans to be mekil in this case, that once he's nasoi, it's pat besalo. He has a wife, he doesn't have to worry about it, and therefore we're less concerned about it. Bibaitema kiha orile. Or others say that the instructions he gave to him when he told him he could touch his member were the following. The Tani Abba Brei, the Rav Binyamin Bar Chia, brought him the quote from the Braita that was brought by Abba Brei, the Binyamin Bar Chia, Aval Mesayeh Bebeitzim Milamata. One can use their scrotum to lift up the member, meaning that you can aid or abet the member and the urinating using touching the scrotum and not touching the member itself. Or others say still that he gave him this instruction. Da'amar Rabbi Yabau, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Gvul Yesh Lo. Miatara ulamata mutar. There is a point at which the stimulation is not effective to the member. That is from the atara, from the crown downwards, is mutar. Miatara ulamala letzad aguf, as Rashi says. From the atara up towards the body is asur. So if he holds it by the tip of the member, then it would not be stimulating. It's not clear here if the answers of the Gemara are mutually exclusive or they're all inclusive. The Rambam here only paskins like the last answer, which is that if you're married, there is no problem. On the other hand, the Rosh and the Shulchan Aruch paskin like all of the answers over here, and any one of these would be a sufficient reason to be allowed to touch the member and not be an issue. Although Tosafot at the beginning of the Amud does qualify that and say that's only in a case of Tzorech Godol that we allow any of these dispensations. It's not a dispensation in general. The Balei Tosafot earlier asked, wait, we have all these solutions to the problem. Why, before when we brought the Mishnah from Truma, did the Gemara not offer all of these possible solutions? The Gemara said, oh, it has to be Mamat Litava. He was using a thick cloth, according to Abaye. Why didn't the Gemara bring these solutions? You have a possibility that grabbed it by the Atara, instead of grabbing it lower down. The Balei Tosafot would say that it wouldn't have worked over there. Over there, he already had, the emission was happening. He was trying to stop the semen from leaving the body. There, grabbing the atara would not be sufficient to stop it, and therefore he had to grab it fully, and that's why that wasn't a solution. Number two is, Tosafot says, the Gemara over there quoted it as a shita of Rabbi Eliezer. And why don't we just say the Chachamim disagree? And that's how you have a solution to the problem in Truma. The Balei Tosafot say that the Rabbanu disagreed with Rabbi Eliezer, only disagree by urinating. And that's because by urinating, there's an offsetting factor, which is the negative rumors that are going to be associated if he urinates and splashes on himself. So that's why over there, they let you touch the member because of the otherwise negative ramifications. But in other situations, like the case of Truma, where you don't have that, they would not permit it, and they would agree with Rabbi Eliezer. Or the Balei Tosafot would say, in the end, the Chachamim might be molded to Rabbi Eliezer. He quotes a number of Gemarot, one from Brachot, and one later on in our Perek, where it seems like even the Chachamim seem to agree with this position of Rabbi Eliezer. The other thing the Baal Tosafot asks is, if this whole problem of urinating away from the body is because of the splashing of the urine on the individual, why don't you just be mishafshef? Just wipe it off afterwards. Wipe it off afterwards, there's no problem. Nobody's going to know that it was splashed there, and then you solve your problem. So why do you have to touch the member to solve that problem? The Baal Tosafot say that if you hold the member or you aim the urination or do it in a place where it won't bounce back, over there, maybe you'll have a couple of drops that come on the body. Those you can wipe off. On the other hand, if you urinate without controlling the urination, there it's going to splash all over the place, and it's going to be too difficult to wipe it out. People are going to know that something happened, and therefore you don't have that solution of being mishafshef in that situation. But so now the Gemara moves back to the issue of motzi shechva zera levatala, and here we'll discuss some of the more of the details of that, which is amarav. A mikasheh atzmo ladat, someone who causes self-stimulation, an erection created by his own doing, yehei bin nidui. He should be excommunicated, as Tosafot says, doesn't mean he puts himself in nidui. He's ra'oi that they should put him in nidui, they should excommunicate him for such behavior. Though the Shulchan Aruch says that he actually is immediately in nidui. It happens passively or by itself. You don't need any active excommunication of such an individual. Valema asur. Why don't you just say that it's a sur? What do you mean, to be in nidui? Just simply say that you're not allowed to intentionally cause yourself to have an erection. The answer is, dikimagare yitzara nafshei. Because that causes a buildup of desire within the individual. So the problem is bigger than simply being a sur. It's a sur with broader ramifications. Because that stimulation then is going to cause things to move forward, and can cause even more problems down the road, which is that stimulation makes the person act or do things in order to fulfill those desires, and that's going to lead to even worse things down the road. Rabbi Yami Amar Nikra Avaryan, he's called a violator, a sinner. Shikach umanato shel yetzer hara. This is the way the yetzer hara works. Ayom omer lo asekach. Today he tells him, just do this little thing. Ulamachar omer lo asekach. The next day, he inures him to that fact, and then he tells him to do a little more. He eventually gets him to the point where he says, go worship Avodah Zarah, and he does it because he did it in incremental steps. It's a slippery slope. It's not something that he does in a moment. It's something that builds over time. So this seems like a little thing over here, but this little thing is just the beginning of a process that's going to lead down a slippery slope. And that's why we say that either Shebi Nidoy or he's called an Arvayan, Ika de Amre, some say Amar Rabbi Avi, Kome Viatsmoli De Hur, if a person brings themselves to these fanciful thoughts, thoughts of desire, Ein Machzi Neito Tobi Mechitzato Shal Kodesh Baruch Hu, that person is blocked from entering into the area where Hashem is in Olam Haba. He's blocked or pushed away in Olam Haba from coming close to a Kodesh Baruch Hu. It says here, this is a quote again from the story by the son of Yehudah, by Onan, by Yera Beinei Hashem. There it says that what he did was seen as being evil in the eyes of Hashem. And it says in the Tehillim, Kilo kel chafetz resha ata, that you are a God that does not want evil. Lo yigurcha ra. Evil will not dwell with you. Now, the Gemara doesn't have this here, but if you look at Masorta Shas, he brings the continuation of the Limud, which helps to actually enhance what's said here. It says, Amar Rabbi Elazar, my lo yagur chara. What does it mean that evil will not dwell with you? Lo yagur v'murgurcha ra. In your mechitza, ra will not exist. That's exactly what's being said here. Vayera tells you that that which Onan did was ra. What was he doing? Hashchatat zera levatala. That's ra. And it says here in the Pasuk that Hashem doesn't want those that do evil, and those that are ra will not dwell with him, will not be in his mechitza. So that really serves to support or corroborate the statement that was made by Rabbi Yami in the understanding of the Pasuk. And then it says, Ve'amar Rabbi Elazar. So now that's why you understand why there's a vav, a chibur here, because that last statement was made by Rabbi Elazar as well. Ma dichtiv, what is meant by the Pasuk? In Ishayahu Aleph, the Haftorah, for Shabbat Chazon, Yideichem Damim Mileu, that your hands were full of blood. What does that mean? Elu Amina Afim Biyad. Those are the ones that do ni'uf by hand, meaning that they are masturbating. That is the ones that are yadechem damim aleyu. Now again, the Gemara sees the hashchatat zera levatala as killing because of the lost opportunity of children that could have been produced. Tana debei Rabbi Shmuel, lo tinaf, lo tei becha ni'uf, ben beyad, ben beregel. Lo tinaf is not just simply, do not commit adultery, but also lo tei becha ni'uf. Lo tinaf means you should not be involved in ni'uf. And how is that? Ben beyad, ben beregel. That's whether the stimulation happens beyad, again, self-stimulation or beregel, by the contact between the member and the leg and the hand. That's also a violation of lotin af. So over here, the achronim point out, and this has nafkamino de halacha, that it seems to be that there are two problems with hashchatat zera levatala. That is that there is an inherent problem of the hashchata. The problem is that it goes to waste. It's not being used for the constructive purposes for the creation of man. And that in itself is problematic, which is the otzat zera levatala. The vatala part is the problem with that. There's another problem, which is the derech hotza'ah. The way that the shikva zera is brought out or released, that there's a separate iser for. That is supported by this lotinaf over here. That there's a separate iser doraita to have zera be expelled in a manner that's not derech bi'ah. And that's what's happening over here. This is bi'yad uberegel. It's not being done through a derech bi'ah. And so that's the double isur over here, which involves, first of all, like the case of Onan, might be only one of those two problems. Over there, he was having biyah. The hotza was derech biyah. The problem was that he was mashchit the zera, that he didn't use the zera because he didn't allow her to become pregnant. On the other hand, you could have the reverse, where you could have it that it's not being mashchit the zera, but the derech hotza is the problem. And that's why the women might also be included under this restriction of lotinaf. If you believe that they also have zera, and that zera levatala could be a problem, irrespective of the mitzvah of peru or vuk, because there are two different problems with hashkata zera levatala. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, in writing about in vitro fertilization, speaks about this issue. And that's why it has a nafkamina l'alocha, which is that even though in vitro or artificial insemination, over there, when you're motzi the zera, it's not the vatala. You're going to use that zera in order to fertilize the ovaries of the woman. So in that case, it's not the vatala. He still says the manner or mechanism by which you have the hotzat zera makes a difference. You can't have it through hotzat yad v'regel. It has to be done in a way that the hotza'ah doesn't have the hotzat yad v'regel. The way that it is released is also important. And that comes up again in these situations where they're using artificial insemination as to how you produce or how you get the zera. Because there it's clearly not the batala, but it's derech yad v'regel, and therefore you have to be careful about how you produce the zera. So many of the achronim point out this dual problem with hotzat shikva the zera the batala, and through that they try to explain many of the different problems or heterim that exist in these situations, which is that by derech bi'ah, we're going to be much more mekil, because then you don't have the problem of the hotza'ah. It's only the question of it's levatala. And levatala can be overcome. For instance, if a woman's already pregnant. So over there, where the woman's pregnant, it's not the levatala. On the other hand, the hotza'ah has to be done in a manner that is not a problem of hotza'ah. So if it's done derech bi'ah, maybe by a pregnant woman, it wouldn't be a problem. But just note that the achronim point to this as being a differentiated isur from the hotza'at zera levatala. All right, Tan Rabbanan, Hagerim, v'amisachakim b'tinokot, makvin et ha-mashiach. The converts, and those that play around with the young girls, they are causing delay in Mashiach coming. Bishlam ha-gerim, the gerim, we understand why that happens. Kid Rabbi Chelbo, like Rabbi Chelbo says, the Amar Rabbi Chelbo, kashim gerim l'Yisrael k'sapachat. The gerim are problematic to Israel, like a sapachat, which is like a nega. It is something that is seen to be negative. Rashi also brings the pasuk in Yeshayahu, which says, "V'nilva ger aleihem, v'nispechua beit Yaakov." So there again, the word sapach is also used. So there's a play on the word sapach, which is they are addendums or additions to you, but they are like a sapachat, like a nega, which means that's a negative addition. So these are addendums to Israel that are causing negative ramifications. The question as to why the gerim are negative, Rashi brings two reasons over here. One reason is because she'ein bekiyam b'mitzvot. They're not experts in the mitzvot. They don't have enough knowledge to perform the mitzvah properly. Umevin pruniot. And therefore they bring pruniot, they bring negative ramifications to Klal Yisrael. The other reason that is brought is because b'nei Yisrael lomdim mehem. People learn from them. They come from a foreign culture. They come from a place where they did things otherwise. And the Jews that they associate with now are going to learn negative things from them. So they're a negative influence on the Jewish nation. Those are two possibilities. Rashi brings a third possibility, which he rejects, which is, V'yesh omer, shekol Yisrael arevim zeh bazeh. The problem is arevut, that we're all responsible one for the other. And that means that they're not doing the right thing. Each individual is going to be responsible for their not doing it because we're arevim. We are guarantors of each other's behavior. And therefore, we're going to be responsible for their problematic behavior. Before, Rashi said it just brings puranut, meaning that they're going to bring negative ramifications to the klal as a whole. Here he is saying that there's personal responsibility. Rashi rejects that and says there's no arevut for gerim. And he says, how do I know that? Because the Gemara in Sota, when it says that there's a covenant between all of Klal Yisrael, it says the covenant is repeated 603,000 times 550. That's the count of Bnei Yisrael. Yet there was an Eruv Rav, and there were gerim with them in the Midbar. How come the Gemara only counts 603,550? From that, Rashi concludes that there's only a Revut between Klal Yisrael. Gerim are not subject to a Revut. That's a huge chiddush and a huge halachic issue, which means that if you blew shofar already, you can't blow shofar for a ger because they are not in a Revut. That creates huge halachic problems for that. The Baal Tosafot say that what Rashi asks is not correct. The reason they only mention the 603,550 is because we have an exact count. We know how many people from Bnei Yisrael were in the Midbar when the Arevut was put in place. The Eruv Rav, we never get a number. The Torah never gives us an exact number, so they can't put that into the calculation. But it would have been in the calculation, and there is Arevut. So they, Tosafot, rejects this reasoning of Rashi, so that would then add another problem, which is that we are Arevim for them, and if they're doing the wrong thing, we're going to be personally responsible for the fact that they're doing the wrong thing. So the Baal HaTosafot bring two other possible problems. One here, which is the problem of Shemeshi Shemita'amim B'Yisrael. They cause a dilution of the Yichus of Klal Yisrael. And that is that the Shekhinah is only Shora on Mishpachot HaMiyuchasot, and the Gerim are not considered to be Miyuchasot, and so they cause a dilution of the Yichus of Klal Yisrael. That's another reason brought by the Baal HaTosafot. And he favors that heavily because of the context in which the statement of Rabbi Chelbo was said. He says that makes a lot of sense, and that seems to be what he's saying. Tosafot in Kiddushin brings another reason, which is that there are so many mitzvot in the Torah that say that you have to love the ger, you have to take care of the ger. Ona'ah, if you mistreat the ger, you're going to be in big trouble. The problem is, that's what's going to happen. Nobody can be so careful and not do anything wrong or hurt the feelings of a ger. And so they're a problem, not because their performance, but because of our treatment of the ger. And if we don't treat the ger properly, then we're going to be held accountable for that mistreatment of the ger, and it's a high threshold, a high standard that the Torah puts out. And then Tosafot brings, at the end of the Baal Tosafot in Masechet Kiddushin, Avram HaGer, who is a well-known ger amongst the Rishonim, is in contact with the Baal Tosafot. We have the Rambam also has the letters from a ger like this. Avram HaGer says to explain this Gemara that the reason that the gerim are problematic for Klal Yisrael is because gerim are medaktikim b'mitzvot yoter b'Yisrael. A convert, when they convert, become very meticulous in their performance of the mitzvot. And they're going to make the Jews look bad because they're doing it even better than the Jews. And that's going to cast dispersions on the born Israel performance of mitzvot, because gerim, who come from the outside, are doing things even more meticulously and better. That's generally the case when you have people that are balei tshuva, gerim, that they tend to take the practice much more serious and intensely and do a better performance many times in the mitzvot than people who were born Yisraelim. And that's going to cast negative light or aspersions on the Israel, because how come they're not keeping up? How come they're not performing the mitzvot like the gerim? And that's how Avram HaGer explains this statement of Rabbi Chelbo. Ella misachakim etinok mahi. What does it mean playing around with the young girls? Ilema Mishkav Zachur, if you say that it's referring to sodomy, b'nei skilaninu, forget about the fact that they're causing a delay in Mashiach, they're subject to a death penalty, so that can't be the case. Ela derech evarim, so then if you say that it is just playing around with them and then having problems of seminal emissions, then b'nei babul ninu. That was what we said before, that someone has hotzat zecher levatala, is like b'nei babul. Ela, the case is, denesive ktanot. They marry young girls, dela b'not olidu ninu. They don't have the capacity to give birth. Dame Rabbi Yossi, ein ben David ba, ad sheichlu kol neshamot shebeguf. That ben David doesn't come until all the neshamot that are found in this holding container. These are the future generations that Hashem has in mind to be born, and they're all held in this goof. And these are the future neshamot. Until it's emptied, Mashiach doesn't come. So by engaging with a young lady who doesn't have the capacity to give birth, you're delaying Mashiach because you're delaying the production or the number of children that will be born. And that delay is causing a delay in Mashiach coming. So the Bali Tosfot would say over here, wait a minute, doesn't the Gemara in Shabbat brings the Midrash, a Gadic explanation that if Bnei Israel had kept two Shabbatot in the Midbar, Mashiach would have come right away. How do you reconcile that with this Gemara over here? So Tosfot unbelievably says, no problem, they could have had multiples. Meaning that they could have Shisha Bekeres Echad. They would have accelerated all the births, and all women, when they were pregnant, would have sextuplets, and more, and then you'd be empty out the goof. So that seems to be a really difficult explanation. First of all, the easiest way to deal with it is say that these are different midrashim, whether they argue, whether they're speaking about a different issue. So it's possible that they don't have to be reconciled. Tosafot feels obligated to reconcile them. That's number one. The Maritz Chiyot asks on that from other Agadot, where we find that Mashiach can come at an accelerated pace. And if that's the case, there won't be any time to have all these births take place. If that's true, then how do you solve the problem? Or how does Tosafot deal with this? So in the end, the Marsha solves the problem by saying that it doesn't have to be literally that they have that many, but sometimes you can have an individual that's connected Shishim Ribo, like Moshe Rabbeinu, and therefore you can solve the problem by having a neshama that's equal to many neshamot. And therefore there's a qualitative aspect, not just a quantitative aspect, to this idea of producing neshamot. Shinamar, how do I know this? From the pasuk, that same parak in Yishayahu that we quoted before, Ki ruach melefanai yatov, uneshamot aniyasiti. So over there, the pasuk, again, this is the Aftorah for Yom HaKippurim, and it's a positive part. Before we quoted the pasuk from the beginning, which was the negative things that they were doing, then Hashem says, afterwards, as part of why it's Aftorah for Yom Kippurim, says, Ki lo olam ariv, I will not always be at odds with you. And I will not be angry forever. Ki ruach milefanai yatov, spirits that are in front of me, yatov. Rashi says the translation of atov is like the atufim. Later ones, the less good ones, were for Lavan. Atufim means that it's being held back. There's a delay. V'nu shamot ani asiti. And I also created the life force, or the neshama in individuals. And Rashi says, you dash in the pasuk backwards. Neshamot ani asiti, that the neshamot that I created, ki ruach lefanai yatov. The ruach of Mashiach, or the redemption, will be delayed until those neshamot that I made are brought to fruition. And that is what's brought by here by the pasuk, that you have to empty out the goof. And so these individuals who are with the ktanot have a problem because they are delaying the coming of Mashiach by not engaging with women that are able to conceive. So the Torah and the Shulchan Aruch conclude the restriction against marrying ktana in the problem of outside Shikva Zer Levatala, and the Bach questions that from our Gemara over here. You could answer that it's not Zer Levatala here because this woman eventually will reach a point where she can have a child, and therefore marrying her is not problematic because eventually it would lead to productive relations. Then, how could then you marry as a kena, a woman who's already menopausal, or an akara? How is that then permissible? So that can't be the issue at hand here. And sure enough, the Rosh and the Rama paskin against the Torah and Shulchan Aruch and say that the problem of nosek tana is not a problem of hashkata zera because it's done derech bi'ah. And the problem, as the Taz says, is that the isur of nisak tana is a chumra bilva, like we see in our Gemara over here, that the problem is because it is seen as delaying the Mashiach, but not because there's an inherent problem with marrying the Ktana. It's just seen negatively or in a negative light. And me Ikarat Din, you can marry a Ktana or an Akara, assuming that you've accomplished Prur or Vu, and the problem is just that you're not helping out, you're not contributing, and therefore we look on it negatively, but not because it's outside Shara Levatala. Right, Banashim Tikatsets. By a man, it says to cut off his hand. Ibailu, Dinatznan, all the Tututznan. How literally are we to take the Mishnah? The Mishnah says to cut off the hand. Does that mean that literally you cut off his hand? Or is it Latuto? Is it a curse? It should be that his hand is cut off. Dinatznan, maybe you should say we take it literally, Kahad Rav Huna. Like the case of Rav Huna in Sanhedrin, the Katz Yado. He cut off the hand of an individual who raised his hand against another party. He took extra judicial action in order to stem a problem. But you see there that he actually cut off the hand of the individual. And maybe over here too, it means literally cut off the hand of the individual. Oh, the Tutun's not. Or is it still really just a curse? Tashma. We can learn it from here. The Tanya, Rabbi Tarfon Omer, Yadli Ama, Tikatseitz Yado Al Tiburo. If your hand is going towards the Ama, or if you touch the Ama, it should be cut off on your stomach. Amrulo, they said to him, Halo Kreso Nivkat. If you do that, isn't it going to cause his stomach to burst or to be cut open? Amlen, Mutav Tigbaka Kreso, Bal Yared the Ber Shachat. Better that his stomach is ruptured than he goes down to Gehinom. So you see from here that we're taking it very literally, which is Iyamar Pishlama Dinatznan. You say it's literally, I understand now why his stomach is rupturing is because you're taking it literally, you're cutting off his hand. If you're saying it's a curse, my kreso nivkat. And what's the Chachamim's response to him that if you cut off his hand on his belly, that you're going to cause a rupture in his belly? Elamai, so what are you going to say? Dinatznan? That we're taking it literally? Lo, sagi delaval tiburo. If you're going to take it literally, then it only works if it's on his belly? Why do you have to cut his hand on his belly then if it's a dina? Dina just means that you have to cut off the hand, period. What does it have to do with being on the stomach? It's a ella hachi kamar. The Bali Tosafot over here say that the Gemara is changing gears now and saying it's not dina tznan, it's latuta tznan. It is a curse. Although the Gemara reads as if it's dina tznan, even in this new understanding of Rabbi Tarfon's statement, nevertheless the Bali Tosafot say that the Gemara switched gears now and saying it's latuta. Ella hachi kamar Rabbi Tarfon. This is what he's saying. Anyone whose hand that descends below his belly button, tikatseitz, it should be cut off. Amrulo, the Rabbi Tarfon, yashav lo kotz bikreiso. What happens if he has a thorn or something stuck in his belly button and his stomach? Lo yitzlenu. He shouldn't take it out. He should just leave it there. Amrulam, lo. You can't take it out. You can't let your hand go below your belly. Falo kreiso nivkat. If you don't attend to this issue, then your stomach's going to be ruptured, or there are going to be negative ramifications of that. Better that his stomach ruptures, then he goes to Be'er Shachat. So again here, sounds like they're taking it pretty literally, the whole thing, because he's saying that let the stomach rupture. Although all he's saying is that the hand below the belly button is an indication, don't let the hand go below the belly button. Tosafot takes that as meaning that the Gemara switched and saying it's a curse. That one's hand should not go below their belly, and it'll be cursed. A person who puts their hand below their belly, the Chachamim say, well, if he's going to be cursed, what should he do in situations where there's a physical problem that he needs to rectify? And the Rabbi Tarfon says, better he doesn't deal with it and lives with the ramifications of that than rather than put his hand below his belly button, because obviously putting one's hand below their belly or their belly button is to reach their ama, and that leads to all the things that we spoke about before, the stimulation and otzat shechva zelavatala, which we have negative associations with. All right, next Mishnah. Hachereshet vashotah vasuma, a woman who is deaf, a shota, a woman not of sound mind, vasuma, and a blind woman, v'shenitrifadata, and this is a woman who, she's not of sound mind congenitally, but nitrifadata means that she lost her mind because of a sickness or an ailment or an illness. If they have fully functional women who take care of them, then they can eat truma. Meaning that since someone else is checking them to ensure that they're not tmeim and helping them to go to the mikveh when they are tmeim, those caretakers can then ensure that they have points in time when they're tohurim, and they can eat truma based on that. They can't deal with it themselves because they don't have the capacity to deal with it themselves. But if someone's helping them, they can do it. Why can't a deaf person do their own check? The problem of checking is simply looking and visibility. She can see, so she can see what coming out of her body, what she can spell from the body, what's on the checks that she does. Why does she need someone else to help her out? Detanya, and even more so, we have Amar Rabbi, Chereshet Hayta Bishkunateinu. Rabbi says there was a deaf woman that lived in our neighborhood. Lo dayash bodeket atzma. It's not enough that she checked herself. Ela shechavrotei ro'ot umarota. Her friends brought her their sightings or their checks to tell them whether it was problematic or not. Rashi says over here, she'ayta bikia b'marat dam tamei, b'dam tahor. She was an expert in what was considered to be dam tamei and dam tahor. So they used to bring it to her to ask her. She is the first yoetzet halakha that they have today where women can go to other women and ask them if the dam they're seeing, the color of the dam they're seeing, is considered to be dam tahor or dam tamei. And that's what was happening here. Over here, it doesn't speak about any hakra'a. And the way that the poskim deal with this is to say that they're allowed to check when it's things that are obvious. When it's something that is clearly dam tamei or clearly dam tahor, she can give the information because that's not hakra, that's not psak halacha. When it comes to something where there needs to be hakra, a decision as to whether it's on the border or something like that, then it has to be passed on to someone who is a rav esmicha, and they have to give hakra with regards to that. And that's the way that many of the yotzot halacha work, is that if they have an obvious marodam, they give them the answer. If it's something that needs hakra, then they pass it on to a rav to get hakra with regards to those marot. So Gemara answers, Hatam b'midaberet v'eno shomat. Over there, that woman had the capacity to speak, but she was deaf. Halacha, in the Mishnah, it's a case v'eno midaberet v'eno shomat. A case where she doesn't speak and she doesn't hear. She's deaf and mute. Okay, it's none, like we have in the Mishnah, Cheresh, shedibru chachamim b'chol makom. The Cheresh that the chachamim speak about all over Shas is v'eno shomeo v'eno midaber. It's someone who is a deaf mute. Now, again, in their day, being deaf-mute meant that you were the equivalent of a shoteh, because you had no capacity for education, and you had no capacity for expression. Given that, you were like a shoteh. You couldn't do anything. You weren't functional in any way. Today, many of the modern postgame, including Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, point out that where we can educate people that are deaf-mute, and it's clear that they're intelligent individuals, then they don't have a status of a shoteh anymore because they're clearly not like a shoteh. And this is determination in Chazal based on what was happening at their time for someone who was a deaf mute. But if today it's different, then we would treat them differently halachically. Hasuma, ihi, tibdok lenafsha, betekzei lechaverta. By suma, why does she have to have someone else check her? Why doesn't she do her own check and then hand it to her friend to look at, and then she'll tell her what she's seeing? So I'm Rabbi Yossi Bechanina, Suna Eno Mishnah. Drop Suma from the Mishnah. You're right. Suma doesn't need an outside party to be supervising the situation. They can do it on their own and just have someone else look at it. B'shenitrafa da'ata, hainu shota. Isn't that the same as a person who lost their mind? That's two ways to describe the same thing. Shenitrafa da'ata machmat choli. The difference between someone who's not of sound mind versus someone who lost their mind because of a sickness. And that's the difference between shota and nitrafadata. Tarabanan, kohen shote, a kohen, again, who is not of sound mind, matbilin oto, you can't take him to the mikveh to make him tohar, umachilin oto truma va'erev, and then that evening, you can have him truma to eat, umishamrim oto shlo ishan, and you make sure that he doesn't sleep, because if he's yashin, if he sleeps, tameh. It will become tamei, because then there's the possibility that he had a seminal omission, which we can't check for. Only he would know, but he's a shoteh, and he can't indicate to us. Lo yashen tor. As long as he doesn't sleep, then he's gone to the mikvah. He has tefillas yom, erev shemesh. He's now tor from any shechvat zera. So as long as he remains awake, and there's no possibility of shechvat zera, then he remains tor, and he can eat truma until he goes to sleep. We make for him a little pouch that they put on his member so that they can check if there was a seminal emission, and then they'll know whether he's tamei or tahor. Amrlo, kosher kei, maybe de chimum. No, we don't want to do that because that could be stimulating putting that on him could cause the semen omission. Forget about checking for it. It could be the cause of the problem. According to you, how do we solve the problem of a shoteh? Because if you can't check, because you don't put something on him, then what's going to happen? It's not a problem. If he goes to sleep, he's tamei. But if he stays awake, he's tahor. And that will be the case where he's tahor. Lidvarecha, according to your solution to the problem, Shema yiretzi ba kechardal betivla bekis. According to you, your solution isn't good because even if you capture it by putting this pouch on his member, you still have the problem that maybe there was a small amount that came up and then it was absorbed into the walls of the pouch and we can't see it. So then maybe that's not a good solution. Tana mishum Rabbi Eliezer amru. So there, the solution to that is that we have a braita from Rabbi Eliezer that says, Osim lo kis shomatechet. They make him a pouch out of metal because that's not absorptive and there it's not a problem. Amr Abaye v'shel nechoshet. And you should use copper, brass for that. Shkidetanya, because we have a braita. Yudomer, roinoto, gibolim, shalizov, kilein, shal nechoshet. When it comes to the paraduma, we just learned recently, that in order to be tamei, for carrying the waters of the paraduma, they have to have a shiur hazaa in there. They have to have enough liquid in there to do a hazaya. That definition is based on the amount that comes off of the bulrushes that are used to do the sprinkling. But bulrushes are absorptive. So do you need enough to be absorbed into the bulrush plus sprinkle? Or do you just need enough to sprinkle? And what Rabbi Yehuda says is, we look at the gibolim, we look at these stalks that you're going to use for the sprinkling, as if they're made out of copper, they're made out of brass. And then we say, how much liquid, do you have enough liquid in there to sprinkle? So what they're saying is that it's how much liquid you need to sprinkle, independent of what needs to be absorbed into the rushes that you're using for the sprinkling. So that means that you only need a small amount. You don't need the amount to fill the rushes. How do I determine that? You look at the rushes as if they were solid metal. What metal? Nechoshet. You see from that, that nechoshet is not an absorptive metal. That's why they mention it. That's what you should make this kis out of. Amar Papa, Shmamina, Michnasayim Asurim. From this you see that wearing shorts or maybe even a boxer-like materials is problematic. Vaktiv. Don't the Kohanim wear Michnasayim? So isn't that a problem? How could it tanya? That is like this braita. Michnasay Kohanim, Lamahim Domim, what are they similar to? Kamin Palmanaya Shel Prashim. It is like the, Rashi calls it a sinar. It's like the cape of the Prashim, either means of the cavalrymen, or Prashim means Pushim, of those that are Makbin on Tumandara. It goes the malad motnaim, goes up to the waist until the loins, and the matad yerechaim, and down below, it goes all the way down to the thighs, or covers over the thighs, meaning that it's a very baggy type of pants. It's almost like a knickers type of pants, and that way it doesn't rub against the member and cause stimulation. V'eshlem shnatsim, and they have these ties or ways to close it up, meaning that it goes on loosely, and then you tie it at the top to lock it in place. And they don't have, Rashi brings two interpretations. One is it doesn't have a place to urinate, doesn't have a place to defecate from. Rather, you have to take them off in order to do that. Or the other possibility is that they're not so tight that they wrap around the rear of the individual into the area of the Beit HaNekev, which is the anus. Below Beit Da'erba, not in the front, they're not closed in over there so that they hug tightly. They're very loose over there. And therefore you solve the problem by keeping them loose. And that's why it is not stimulative. So in that case it would be maybe better to wear boxers than briefs because they don't rub so tightly, they don't rub against the member. Amar Abayi Rukhvei Gmalim Asurim Lechol B'Truma. Those that ride camels can eat truma because the assumption is that they're stimulated by the fact that they rub against the body of the gamal, and that's going to cause an emission, which will restrict them in truma. Tanyanami Ochir, a breaker that supports that, Rukhvei Gamalim Kulam Rishayim. Ones who ride the camels are Rishayim. Hasapanim, the sailors, Kulam Sadikim, they're all Sadikim, as Rashi says, Shidarim is Sakana. They're always in danger, and they are therefore always looking to Hashem for salvation. It's akin to the story of the sailors by Yonah, that those sailors are looking to God to save them, and in the end they become huge balei tshuva because of what happened out at sea. Hachamarim mehen rishayim mehen tzadikim. For the chamarim, the donkey haulers, some of them are rishayim, some of them are tzadikim. Those are the short-haul individuals. The gamalim are the long-haul individuals. Tosfot asks from the Mishnah at the end of Kiddushin, which says, Kimalim rabam kisherim, that the ones who are the camel drivers, most of them are kisherim, akin to the sapanim, because the gamalim are going through deserts and through dangerous areas, therefore they're tzadikim. Chamarim rubam listim, and that the donkey drivers, most of them are thieves. It says, V'esh lomar d'hochamayim rochvim. Over here we're dealing with riding, and because of hirhur. So with riding in hirhur, by the gemalim, it's much more problematic. As far as behavior, those that are with the gemalim or the caravans of gemalim tend to be better because they're in more danger, and therefore the mishabe libam l'shamayim. Whereas the chamarim are people who are cheaters in masava matan, because they're doing short haul and their profits are limited, and therefore they try to scrape every piece out of it. That's how most Rishonim explain the difference here, that over there it's dealing with the issue of their behavior, their business ethics, and over here it's dealing with the specific issue of Shechvat Zera and Hirhur. Tosafot creates a different distinction, which he bases on his thinking here, not like Rashi, that you're mitchameim from riding on it, but because it causes Hirhur. And the Baal Tosafot say that there's a difference between the riding here, where the Gamalin and Chamarim are actually riding with their loads on the animal. That's where you have a problem of hirhur. Whereas the Mishnah and Kiddushin is speaking about situations in which they walk alongside of their animals. And over there's not the issue of hirhur. There's only the issue of their business ethics. And that's what's being discussed over there, that gamalim are much more ethical and libam mishubad l'shamayim versus those of the chamarim who are not so moral. So igadamre, some suggest, had mikaf, had lo mikaf. The difference between a gamal and a chamor, why is it by the gamalim that they are rishayim and by the chamorim they are not? That is because by a chamor, most people ride on a saddle. And therefore, there's no problem with stimulation because then you're on a hard wood or hard leather, that is the saddle. Whereas gamalim, in general, are ridden without a saddle. And that explains the difference between the gamalim and the chamorim. V'igadamre, had the mitartin, had the lo mitartin. Depends on how they're riding. Mitartin means like a scale with two sides. If they're riding normally, then that's a problem because they have their legs split over, and that can cause the stimulation. Hadamotartin is if they ride side saddle, then it's not a problem. And then this answer would explain the difference between the chamarim that are rishayim and tzadikim, which is the way that they ride on their donkey. Are they riding split-legged or are they riding side-saddle? Question of whether it's modifying riding with a saddle, without a saddle, is actually not clear. Though the Shulchan Aruch paskens the kula, that as long as you're riding on a saddle, it's not a problem. If there is no saddle, then you need to ride side-saddle. Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi light among the gunny up here, kid. Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi used to curse anyone who slept up here, kid. Rashi over here says, panav lamalo. Face up, he's flat out on his back. And the problem is that maybe he will become erect and he'll be exposed because it's facing upwards. And that'll be an embarrassment or unbecoming. Or that his hands are near his member and that can cause stimulation. The Balei HaTosafot say that they don't think that the problem here is a problem of being exposed, but rather the fact that you're laying flat on your back causes that the pajamas or the clothing that you're wearing stimulates or rubs against your member. It causes a problem. And then the Gileonei Tosfot bring an additional thing, which is when you lay on your back, the spine warms and that causes a stimulation of the member. That might be the problem. Here Rashi explains a pirkid like the Balei HaTosafot, which means that you're flat on your back. In the Gemara in Brachot, where it says you're not allowed to daven Kriyat Shema HaPirkid, Rashi says, like the Oruch, that means face down. And that's the problem. And then over here too, the problem would be face down, because then the member would be rubbing against the bed, and that would cause a problem. The Balei Tosafot from the Gemarot in Baba Batra by Rabbi Bar Chana prove that the Pirkid means flat on your back. Because over there in one of the stories of Rabbi Bar Chana, it says that the individual took Rabbi Bar Chana out to the desert to see the Meite Midbar, those that died in the Midbar, and they walk under the knee of one of them, on a camel with a spear upwards and they could fit under it. But it's clear if their knee is bent and they're going under it, that they're laying flat on their back. And over there it says they were pirkit on their back. And that's why Tosafot says that a pirkit means flat on your back and not face down. Rashi over here says the same thing as the Bali Tosafot, though Rashi in Brachot says like the Oruch that it means face down. And Tosafot disagrees with that because of this story by Rabbi Bar Chana. Is that really a problem? Amar Rav Yosef, Pirkidan, lo yikra kriyat shma. Someone who's flat on their back cannot read kriyat shma. Kriyat shma udu lo yikra, ha? Migana shapir dami. He can't read kriyat shma, but if he wants to lay like that, he wants to sleep like that, it'd be fine. Gemara says, inyan migana kimatsli shapir dami. As far as sleep is concerned, if he just tilts himself a little bit, that's okay. He can't be flat on his back, but if he tilts himself a little bit to the side, you're fine. Then the kriyat shma kimatsli asur. By kriyat shma, it's not enough just to tilt yourself to the side. You need to turn completely onto your side in order to say kriyat shma. Va, Rabbi Yochanan matsli bikari. Kriyat shma. What about Rabbi Yochanan, who just tilted himself over to the side a little bit and said kriyat shma? He says, shiny Rabbi Yochanan, the bal basar ava. Rabbi Yochanan was different because he was a very large, hefty man. And he couldn't turn onto his side. So the only way he could do it was to be matzli, to tilt himself a little bit. But one who can tilt themselves is obligated to tilt themselves onto the side in order to say kriyat shma. When you do it on your side completely, that's when it's mutar to say kriyat shma that way. It's brought down the halacha. It's still better when you say kriyat shalamita to sit up completely and say kriyat shma. But if you're laying down, you should do it on your side, not flat out on your back. That's from our Gemara here. Or from the Gemara in Brachot, where Rashi says even face down, you shouldn't do it. Neither of those are appropriate. And if the person is too large or to tilt themselves over totally to their side, they have to tilt to their side. Now, as far as sleeping is concerned, you can solve the problem on a pirkidan or pirkid by simply tilting a little bit, and that will avoid all the problems that are raised here with regards to sleeping in a manner that is pirkid. Okay, we'll stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Yudalit Amud Aleph.